From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. French troops headed into battle this morning in Mali. Not just bombing from the air now, but on the ground. Close combat, we're reading, at the edge of the Sahara. Last year, rebels took over the north of Mali. Timbuktu declared an Islamic State. Al-Qaeda was on board. Now, Al-Qaeda's front and center, and Europe, France, is taking up the fight straight south in Africa. The U.S. is applauding, and maybe more, this hour on point, the storm in Mali. You can join the conversation. Was France right to step in to save Mali's capital, Bamako? Can you even picture Mali on a map? Do you see why Europe is up in arms, literally? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Here's the sound of French troops unloading equipment in Bamako earlier this week. And in they came. You can see a gallery of images from Mali at our website, onpointradio.org, if you can't even picture it. Here was one Malian man in the capital of Bamako earlier this week, telling the BBC he was glad for the French intervention.
Without them, he says, the terrorists would have taken this city. We would be refugees by now.
But there were warnings as well. Earlier this week, in a telephone interview with the French radio station Europe 1, an Islamic militant leader, Omar Oulhamaha, said the French intervention was a bad move.
France has opened, for all the French people, the gates of hell. It has fallen into a trap much more dangerous than Iraq, Afghanistan, or Somalia. And this is only the beginning.
Let's go straight to Mali. Joining us now from Mali is Adam Nossiter, West Africa Bureau Chief for the New York Times. He's been reporting the French movement into combat. Adam, thanks very much for joining us. Where are you and what's the latest, Adam?
I'm just leaving the military base in Bamako, where the French forces have set up their headquarters. The French are engaged on the ground, as you said, Tom, in the west of the country. They're trying to root out Islamists who have taken over a small town that's only about 200 miles from Bamako. And so they've surrounded the town, and it's a very difficult operation for them.
They came in, last week with jet fighters bombing in the north. How are they deploying now? How did they head out of Bamako? In jeep convoys? Or paint the picture for us, Adam.
Well, last night, a convoy of perhaps 60 or 70 armored vehicles left Bamako, headed west. And the French wouldn't tell us exactly where they're headed, but we can guess because the point of Islamist incursion into southern Mali is this town of Diabali, where the Islamists have literally gone into the town, and they've moved into the residents' houses. They kicked the residents out. So it's going to be very difficult to get them out of there without a lot of civilian casualties. And this is what the French forces and the Malian forces are concerned about right now.
We're reading here a live blog from Al Jazeera, Adam, that says the French have begun shelling the town. Who are the forces arrayed against them in Diabli likely to be? Who's there?
Well, it's a coalition of radical jihadist elements, including Al-Qaeda's local affiliate, Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, an Al-Qaeda offshoot called the Movement for Unity and Oneness in West Africa, and an ethnic Tuareg Islamist group. And so they're all fighting together. They're all quite well-trained. They're all battle-hardened. And they have some excellent weapons that they stole from the arsenal of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi after Gaddafi fell from power in 2011.
You know, Adam, last week when the bombing was happening from the jet fighters in the sky, it sounded as though the French, they were talking about something quick, just a matter of weeks. That has already changed. They're on the ground. They're talking a longer-term engagement. This thing seems to be developing maybe in directions that they did not first anticipate. Does it look that way to you?
Well, Tom, that's exactly right. I think this is going to be more difficult for the French than perhaps they anticipated, because they're up against a very mobile, very well-trained, very battle-hardened force that's perfectly well adapted to the semi-desert terrain of Mali. And it doesn't hang around in towns and cities or outside of them in mass formations the way a conventional army does. The French can bomb, but then the Islamists will go into the bush and hide out and wait and then come back again. So this is not going to be an easy conventional fight, and it's not going to be a fight that can be resolved by bombing alone. This is Afghanistan Redux, as it were. It's a smaller force than the Taliban, but in some ways it's even more adapted to the terrain, and in some ways it's even more uniquely capable of holding on to what it has than the Taliban.
So here's this hourglass-shaped country there over in the sort of western bulge of Africa, but the north and eastern part of that hourglass desert, the Sahara Desert, where the Tuareg have been based, the south and west portion of the hourglass, right up against Sierra Leone and, Senegal and Guinea and West Africa. The open desert would seem like easy terrain for the French to track people down, but Adam Nasseter, you've been talking with people describing big underground caves, desert hideouts, been used by bandits for years, that they're in. What have you heard about these underground redoubts?
Well, the Islamists have had a long time to prepare for this fight. They've been masters of the desert, essentially, for the last 10 years. And they've been stockpiling their weapons. They know how to hide them. They know how to navigate the Sahara Desert, which is vast. It's a space that's almost unimaginable to Americans. It covers a good chunk of the African continent. The Islamists are masters of it. That's where they live. So they know where to hide things, and they're quite rich because for the last 10 years, they've made a very good business out of kidnapping any Westerner unlucky enough to cross their path. And they get an average of $3-4 million per Westerner they kidnap and ransom money. So they have the financial means to keep themselves in business for a while. And they have perfect knowledge of the terrain that essentially they are the only ones with knowledge of.
You share this description of a vast system of underground caves big enough to drive cars into. Jihadists gathered inside, stockpiling weapons, vehicles, generators, fuel. And you say among them, not a small number of Islamist fighters, many of them bearded foreigners speaking Arabic, as in from where, Adam?
Well, this is developed into an international jihadist cause. So there are reliable reports that these fighters are coming from Afghanistan, from Pakistan, from Algeria, from Morocco, from the Western Sahara, from Mauritania, from all around the region. This has become a number one fight for the jihadis. And I think that it is becoming even more so now that the old colonial power, France, is so heavily engaged.
The French defense minister, you quote, talking about fearing the establishment of a terrorist state within range of Europe and of France. What is Europe's fear here? Make it acute for us.
One country down from the Mediterranean Sea, and it's become an enormous base for al-Qaeda and its affiliates.
I guess that's big enough. The United States says it's committed to supporting the French mission. What does that mean? Have we deployed drones? Do you know? Are we offering transport? I see Germany's offering air transport now. What about the U.S.?
Well, the U.S. has made vague pledges of enlisting its reconnaissance assets to help the French spot these Islamists, and that's certainly something that's very high on the French priority list. Whether that's happened yet or not, I don't know, but one can assume that it will, and that will be a critical piece of the puzzle for the forces arrayed against the Islamists, because a key problem is simply finding them over such a vast expanse. We're only talking about 2,000 or 3,000 men, in a huge territory. So spotting them is a critical element, and the U.S. Can certainly help the French.
You're there in Mali. Do you think the French were exaggerating when they described the Al-Qaeda and the radical Islamists as having been within days of taking over the capital, the country?
Well, I don't think so, because the Malian army has again and again proven itself to be almost a phantom army, an army that is won in name only, incapable of stopping anything that comes at it. So essentially, the path was open to the Islamists from their stronghold in northern Mali. There was nothing in the way. And I think that's why the French got so worried and struck so quickly and unexpectedly last Thursday. The Islamists would have kept advancing, and there was nothing to stop them.
Adam Nossiter with the New York Times. They're outside the Mali's capital of Bamako, as the French begin close combat north and up there. Adam Nossiter, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the storm over Mali, Al-Qaeda in Africa, the French in Mali, the stakes for everyone as French troops move from air attacks to close combat on the ground today. French came in last week from the air on Monday at a press briefing in Brussels. NATO spokeswoman Oanu Lungescu said the alliance welcomed France's military intervention.
France has taken swift action to roll back the offensive by the terrorist groups in Mali, and we're hopeful that such efforts will help restore the rule of law in Mali and also reduce the threats posed by terrorist organizations.
The NATO spokesperson there early this week, the French ground commander, Colonel Paul Guise, discussed his mission with ITN, Independent Television News.
The military unit I command will not stay in Bamako, which will be our military base, but will go further north and combat the terrorist groups there, in addition to the airstrikes that we have undertaken in the past 2 days.
We'll go further north, he said. Now that's been done. They're there. And that on-the-ground contact combat is reportedly commenced. Speaking from Dubai on Tuesday, the French president, Francis Hollande, made clear his country's goals for Mali in the wake of French airstrikes.
You're asking, what will we do to the terrorists if we find them? We'll destroy them, make prisoners if possible, and make sure they can't do any more harm in the future.
And U.S. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta talking from Spain about objectives for U.S. involvement in Mali.
With regards to the objective in Mali, as far as I'm concerned, the fundamental objective is to make sure that AQIM, Al-Qaeda, never establishes a base for operations in Mali or, for that matter, any place else.
We'll see where that goes. The French now engaged on the ground. We're going to talk with the gentleman from Mali, with the gentleman from Washington with a big view right now. With us from Stillwater, Oklahoma, is Asuman Mega. He's a native of Mali, came to the U.S. last August. He was working in Mali to get aid and supplies to people in the north who'd been cut off by the conflict. He's currently a graduate research assistant at Oklahoma State University. He has family in Timbuktu and in the capital city of Bamako. Asuman Mega, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi.
And with us from Washington is Seth Jones. He's associate director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at the RAND Corporation. He's also author of the book Hunting in the Shadows, The Pursuit of Al-Qaeda Since 9/11. Seth Jones, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Tom.
Asuman Mega, let me come first to you. What are you hearing from your family, your relatives in Mali, about the situation there?
I will tell you that the situation in Mali is a concern for everyone in Mali today. As you mentioned before, last week we had it was very challenging for the country because the country was in danger. Al-Qaeda was progressing toward the south, So they controlled a town called Kona, and they were threatening about moving toward the south. So many people in Mali thought this is going to be the end. So my family was calling me from Bamako, and they were really afraid. For people in Timbuktu as well, they were concerned because they were living the situation, which started in Timbuktu, actually, from April the 1st.
Mm-hmm.
So the situation was really tough for both people in Bamako and also in Timbuktu.
So your wife and children in Bamako now in the south, your father in Timbuktu in the north?
So, yes, I have my stepfather and some cousins, and, my larger family is in Timbuktu, and my wife and kids are in Bamako, which is the capital city.
How does your family in Timbuktu describe what has happened in the months that the Islamists have taken over?
I have personally been there when the Islamists took Timbuktu over, and I saw actually what's going on. So they were establishing Sharia law, which is radical Islamic law. So, for example, they have said that women should wear veils, cover their faces, they shouldn't go out. And also they have destroyed all recreation areas like bars, hotels, and also they have forbidden, it was banned to smoke. People cannot smoke in the streets of Timbuktu. And also, for example, they destroyed beauty shops. So many things. And people in Timbuktu, you know, they are outgoing. They want to drink their tea outside their houses. So this was forbidden. It was forbidden for people to come together and sit and have and enjoy life.
We read that the Islamists are Sunni, I guess. There's a long Sufi tradition in Mali, in Timbuktu. We read that some important historical sites have also been destroyed there. Do you know of that, Asuman?
Yes. Actually, in Timbuktu, we have 333 saint shrines, and we also have monuments. So the Islamists, when they came to Timbuktu, and they think like... people in Timbuktu worship the shrines. Basically, it's not worshiping. People go and ask for favor from the shrines, from God. And so they said this is like people in Timbuktu are worshiping and they were making second God. And they said, we have to destroy. And they destroyed the shrines, meaning the tombs of saints in Timbuktu. So you know that UNESCO have like 16 World Heritage sites in Timbuktu. So, and the scholars of Timbuktu, they made a declaration addressed to the Secretary General of UNESCO saying that the World Heritage is in danger. From that day, UNESCO has taken some resolution and statement saying that this heritage is in danger. So the Islamists said UNESCO has nothing to do about that. So they started destroying the tombs in Timbuktu.
And then in the south, Bamako, if the French had not intervened, Asuman Mega, do you think that the Islamist jihadis would be in Bamako, the capital city, now? Would they have taken it over?
Yes, most likely, because, you know, from March to 22nd, when we had the military coup, the chain of commandment and everything, there were many issues within the militaries, and also the Malian army is under-equipped. And they cannot face this Islamist group, which is an international network. And I believe that if the French didn't intervene, I could not see anything which prevent them from progressing toward Bamako.
Asuman Mega, please stand by there in Stillwater, Oklahoma, if you would. We're very glad to have your first-hand knowledge with us, native of Mali in the U.S. right now, family in Bamako and in Timbuktu. I want to turn, if I may, for a moment to Seth Jones. Seth, explain to us. I mean, a lot of people can't even picture Mali on a map. Timbuktu is a name we know, but even that, on a map, tough to place. And yet, this is clearly seen as important enough by the French that they're there, first in the air, now on the ground. What has the French so up in arms about what's going on in Mali, Seth?
Well, Tom, I think the issue here is the relationship and involvement of Al-Qaeda and its allies. And it's helpful, I think, very briefly just to describe what we mean by Al-Qaeda here in Mali.
Mm-hmm.
Al-Qaeda still has a weakened command and control node in Pakistan, but it has a series of affiliates that have sworn allegiance or bayat to the Pakistan leadership. One of them is in North Africa, what we call Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, led by Abdelmalek Drukdal. They have been increasingly pushing into several countries in North Africa, including Mali, where they have trained fighters in Nigeria, elements of Boko Haram. And what has the French particularly concerned is their links into extremist networks operating into Europe, including in France and Spain. So the French have had to deal with a history of terrorist attacks. The Spanish in 2004 in Madrid from North African networks, and the idea of an Al-Qaeda linked sanctuary in Mali has the French, frankly, not unsurprisingly, deeply concerned about the future of Mali.
There's so much more we want to learn. Our listeners have questions as well. Let me begin to bring them in. Pam in Williamsburg, Virginia. Pam, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question was why Al-Qaeda chose Mali, and I think you pretty much answered that. I also wanted to know how bordering countries are impacted, in particular Senegal. I have good friends there, and I've visited there and spent much time in West Africa, and I'm very concerned about how others will be impacted, Nigeria as well. Thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
It's a great question, Pam. I mean, part of this, Seth Jones, I guess, just goes straight to the map. Many of us may not have pictured exactly where Mali is, but when you look at it, I mean, it starts abutting up there in the Sahara, Algeria. But go south and west, and it abuts all of West Africa, Senegal, Guinea, the Côte d'Ivoire. It's right in there with Burkina Faso, and Ghana's just beyond that. I mean, West Africa is right there on its border in all those countries. What about if there were a real Al-Qaeda stronghold, never mind Europe for a moment, what about the African implications here, Seth?
Well, Tom, what was interesting is I was in Mali a decade ago looking at this very issue. The U.S. military was involved in what was called at that time the Pan-Sahel Initiative, working with a range of governments in the region to try to prevent this very outcome from happening. I think the concern here is twofold. One is Al-Qaeda looks for weakened states, and they have that in Mali. They have that condition with a coup in a very weak state with little control up in the north.
Last year, last spring, that
last
coup.
Spring, that's right. And they also look for potential allies, Sunni groups that would like to establish an Islamic emirate. And they have that in Mali with groups like Ansar al-Din. So the concern in West Africa is conditions of both weak states and local allies are, you know, potential fruitful grounds for Al-Qaeda expansion.
Are there vulnerable nations on its borders? Or is that paranoid?
No, I think there are concerns in particular about countries like Mauritania, a resurgence of violence in Algeria. There has been growing concern about the Salafist group Boko Haram in Nigeria, and it's done a training on improvised explosive devices in Mali with Ansar al-Din and Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. So I do think there is unquestionably a notable concern about some of this global militancy spreading in parts of this region.
Enough that Europe, France, now literally up in arms. Jeff in Belmont, Massachusetts. Jeff, thanks for calling. You're on.
Tom, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I lived in Mali for several years, initially as a Peace Corps volunteer, and subsequently constructed clinics and such through a private organization I founded. But people might not realize that at one point, Mali was the richest country in the world. The Mandingue Empire stretched from the west coast inward, had huge hoards of gold, salt, copper was the focus of trade in the region.
You're talking long ago when Timbuktu was a rich trading center, I guess.
Exactly. And the Sultan at the time went on a Hajj to Mecca, collapsed the economies of Egypt and Saudi Arabia, given the amount of gold that he transported with him.
But that's a long time ago. I mean, it is dirt poor now, is it not, Jeff?
It is dirt poor now, and partially responsible the colonial influence brought down a lot of the region. Mm-hmm. But Mali is still rich in art and culture and is an Islamic country, as you've indicated. So there's a delicate balance to strike with this current military move by the French and other countries to support the local population and this moderate form of Islam rather than tipping the balance in the favor of the jihadists. The indiscriminate bombing and killing of people is not going to work well for the West. And there's also a concern of handling the refugees that are moving into areas that are already under very great pressure to handle local population.
Hey, Jeff, I'll put that to Asuman, but let me ask you, while we've got you, you were there, it sounds like, a lot. Just describe it for us. What's the terrain of Mali look like? From the Sahara in the northeast to deeper into West Africa in the southeast, what's it look like?
The Sahel, where I was a volunteer, I was actually in the village of Kona. Kona, as you've heard in the news lately, is the village on the frontier of the insurgency and is currently under siege, as I understand. They took it over and they're trying to fight them off. That's a very, I could say, desolate area, not much tree coverage, water's in short supply, animals have long gone. And the southern part of the country, it's much more temperate, tropical type of climate. And so there's very stark going from the north to the south in terms of the environment.
Yeah, Jeff, I appreciate your call. If I may, the break is coming, but Asuman, what about our caller Jeff's concern that military intervention by France so far may drive people toward the Islamists, away from Mali's tradition of moderate Islam?
Yeah, Mali is actually moderate, I would say very moderate Islam. Mm-hmm. And so this French intervention will actually, because people in Timbuktu mainly and in other areas understood that these people who came there, they claim to be Muslims, but actually they are not. Because as people in Timbuktu mentioned to me, we are already Muslims. Why do these people think that they are doing jihad, which means trying to convert us? We are already Muslims, so we don't see any reasons for them to be here and for them to come and say that they have to enhance or to force us to be what we are not. We have been Muslims for centuries.
So what about the French intervention? Most of what we've heard in the media so far is Malians welcoming the French, but does that sound credible to you?
Definitely, definitely. All the friends, all the people to whom I talk to, all the Facebook pages I am on, people really appreciate what France is doing. Because people need freedom. And everybody in Mali understood that the country was kind of failing. So if the French did not intervene, the country will go.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the storm over Mali, Al-Qaeda in Africa, the French in Mali, the stakes for everyone here. Speaking in Paris earlier this week, today the French troops on the ground and in close combat, we're told. But earlier in the week, here was the French defense minister explaining the situation then as he saw it on the ground in Mali.
L'évolution de la situation, oui.
The developments are in line with our expectations. In the east of Mali, the advance of the rebels has been blocked. The town of Kona has been abandoned. The terrorist groups are, in effect, in retreat.
In retreat? Well, it turns out maybe not. And today, French troops on the ground going out to push further. Seth Jones is with us today. He's at the RAND Corporation in their International Security and Defense Policy Center in Washington, D.C., author of Hunting in the Shadows, The Pursuit of Al-Qaeda Since 9/11. Asuman Mega is with us as well, Malian, in the U.S. at the Oklahoma State University, a graduate research associate there, native of Mali, family in Bamako, family in Timbuktu. He's watching very closely and in close touch. Lots of questions for the two of you. Here's from our website, Seth. A listener says, it seems outside the usual MO of Al-Qaeda to try to conquer a nation. Being stateless has always been one of their best defenses. I mean, that's an interesting observation. Here you had François Hollande saying that if the French hadn't gone in, he said earlier on Wednesday, Mali would have been entirely conquered. But what about our listeners saying, hey, that's not what Al-Qaeda usually seems to do, Seth?
Actually, to the contrary, what Al-Qaeda has increasingly moved toward doing, led by its current leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, is to push for the overthrow of a range of regimes in North Africa, the Middle East, and South Asia, and replace them with governments that establish an extreme version of Sharia or Islamic law. And so we've seen, actually, I would say, somewhat comparable efforts by Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, also an Al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, efforts to control significant chunks of territory and over the long run overthrow the regimes. What's different in a sense about Mali than a few other cases is the U.S. at the moment is probably not in danger of a terrorist attack on its homeland being plotted from Malian territory. Yemen would be an example where there is grave concern about active plotting from individuals like Ibrahim al-Assiri. So
yeah.
I think this is one reason why the U.S. is being a little cautious on providing direct assistance, because the level of threat is, while serious, does not appear to be directly focusing on the U.S. homeland.
Asuman, let me pose this one to you from a listener, Ian, who says, just because Al-Qaeda is mingling with local forces does not make Al-Qaeda the masters of the desert. Without local support, Al-Qaeda is nothing in the Sahara. What about that, Asuman?
I don't believe that they need local support, because these people, as it's mentioned, they have kidnapped people, they have kidnapped Westerners, they have money, and it's an international network. When I went to Timbuktu, most of Al-Qaeda fighters I saw in Timbuktu are not locals. They are from Algeria, Somalia, Nigeria, other countries. Actually, it's an international network. So what they created, for example, in Gao was like, so they know that the people were about to survive. They need to survive. So they proposed to some locals some money to join them. And actually, among the youngsters, some people joined them, but this does not represent a large number of people. People really do not want them. And you know that mostly people are displaced in larger cities. They are in the bordering countries like Niger, Burkina Faso, or within the country.
I mean, I'm very curious about how this works, and I'll put it to you as well, Seth, because I'm reading here, we heard Adam Nasser with The Times earlier talking about 100 Islamist fighters. We've heard about maybe 2,000 in total. The Tuareg, the people in the north and west of Mali, the sort of desert nomadic traditional culture there, have made some alliance here. But we've also heard them saying they don't want to go down this Islamist path. I got a little tape here of Mohammed Agosad at the Tuareg Cultural Center. This is in Bamako in Mali, telling Al Jazeera yesterday that most Tuaregs reject strict Islamic law, Sharia.
You can say that maybe there's a fringe group of Tuaregs with the rebels, but most Tuaregs don't support this kind of Sharia, and most Tuaregs aren't a part of this rebellion.
Seth Jones, the Tuareg are a very interesting part of this. People may know the name. I mean, for heaven's sakes, it's on the back of an SUV. I think it's a Volkswagen called the Tuareg. But it's named after this people, the blue people they've been called, because of the indigo they wear, have worn traditionally, how that indigo, so much indigo that it may get into their skin. Great masters of the desert, to quote from one of our listeners there, who ran the caravans through this area for centuries, through Timbuktu and beyond. They've always been kind of hard for the southern capital to keep in the fold. But what about their relationship with the Islamists now, Seth?
Well, I think we are talking about a very small percentage of Tuaregs that are supporting what are very radical jihadists. And I think what several people have already noted appears to be true in this area. They do not have large-scale support. Their version of Islam is way too radical for most in Mali. That's my experience in talking to individuals in northern Mali. And I think this, frankly, is going to be the biggest long-term challenge. And it's been al-Qaeda's challenge in this region for several years. It does not have large-scale support, whether it's among Tuaregs in general or North Africans more broadly.
Let's take a call. Brooklyn, New York. Dave is calling. Dave, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to comment on the fact that they don't have local support. And I've just noticed something. I've just had some experience in the area. Mm-hmm. And I've noticed what happens with the people in the area. There's a kind of a resentment from a lot of black Africans, even black Africans that are Muslims, against a lot of the North African, more Arab types, telling them what to do, and kind of imposing a lot of this Sharia law, which I find a lot of black Africans, and even I'm talking even black Africans that are Muslims, don't really care for. And I'll just tell you the one quick story. This one gentleman, when I was in my time in West Africa, he told me, you know, all this stuff that Al-Qaeda is talking about brotherhood and everything else, he says, when you go to Sudan, he says, a lot of black people are Muslims in the Sudan, but they don't get treated very well because their skin is black. So all this, he tells me, this equality that Al-Qaeda asked for, in practice, it's not really there.
Let us pick it up, Dave. These stripes of color or race, and also of stripes of different flavors of Islam here. I mean, Asuman, I have read of Tuareg people, let's say, complaining about racism because they are lighter skinned than the black African, I guess, ruling elite in Bamako. What about race and culture as a dividing line in Mali, Asuman?
Actually, I will tell you that we do not have this racial discrimination or difference between Malians in truth. Malians, we see ourselves as Malians. So I need to make it clear that we had a rebellion in the north, and people usually call it Tuareg rebellion. So it involved some Tuaregs, but it's not all the Tuaregs in Mali who were engaged in this rebellion. So, and they signed an agreement with the Islamist group in Gao to build a state to divide Mali.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it didn't work. And so when, and then they had a fight, a big fight between MNLA, which is the movement, the National Movement of Liberation of the Azawad, and Ansardin,
the Tuareg
Islamist group. Yes, mm-hmm. The Tuaregs. So when they had this big fight, the Islamists took control of northern major cities. So some of the people who were in MNLA finally joined the jihadist group. So this is what we can consider. We can also call a local support, because some of the MNLA fighters find themselves in the with the Islamist groups.
Though, I mean, what we've heard, Seth, is that the Islamists kind of, yes, they allied with the Tuareg desert folk there, and then sort of turned the tables on them and took charge.
Well, I think what's useful to understand here, and when we talk about support, is that both al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb and its local allies, Ansar al-Din, the Movement mm-hmm. for Oneness and Jihad in West Africa, mm-hmm. have had to resort to pretty sophisticated and significant brutality, coercion, fear, both through targeted assassinations and through propaganda. And so their movement in key areas so far, even over the last week, has probably been more a function of their coercion and fear than it has popular support. I think this will probably come back to bite them in the end.
This can get messy in a hurry. I'm reading an update here from Al Jazeera just from a couple of minutes ago saying that al-Qaeda-linked militants are now holding 41 foreigners hostage, including seven Americans. This is after an attack on a gas field in eastern Algeria. Of course, Algeria with an enormous border with Mali. I don't know if it's related at all, but it gives you a sense of just how messy things can get and how quickly. Comment online here, it's pretty cavalier, but let me just put it out there. Stephen says, is the Mali government, which is known for its corruption, worth the West defending? Says, send in the clowns. I mean, send in the drones. I apologize for the cavalier part of that, but what about it, Seth?
Well, this is actually a challenge. I mean, from a threat perspective, I think the mix of jihadist groups here should be a cause of concern for a range of not just Malians, but also European and American governments. The biggest long-term challenge, though, will be the lack of capacity in the Malian government and concerns about its legitimacy and corruption. So what we've found, I think, across not just North Africa, but South Asia and the Middle East, is you need a somewhat viable government over the long run that can prosecute these kinds of operations, provide basic services to a population as part of a counterinsurgency campaign. Mali is a long way from that right now.
John in Essex Junction, Vermont. John, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Listen, I'm very familiar with that area. I joined the Peace Corps and went to Niger in 1970 and lived in Niger for about 10 years. Worked in Timbuktu, Mopti, Gao. And I just retired in 2009 after 5 years in Senegal. So I know that area.
Okay.
And I know the Tuaregs, and I speak some of their language.
Great.
Listen, I see this as, I don't know if you saw the article in the New York Times yesterday.
Yes.
About how the U.S. Military have been training, just like we did in Central America on a war against whoever, these militias in Mali and Senegal and Niger.
Militias or training the Malian military itself, John?
And what happened? What happened? They defected and they went to the north and they took their weapons with them, and they turned around and they are a big part of the problem, just like our war on terror in Somalia and Yemen and all over Africa is part of this AFRICOM mission, which is very similar to what happened in Central America.
Our time is short. Let us pick it up. That's very interesting. I mean, Seth, what about it? I do know in the coup last year, there's a Captain Sanago who was in that. I know he'd had some intelligence training in the U.S., but what about the U.S. military footprint here and training or otherwise? What do you know of it, Seth?
Well, I've seen it up close over the last decade. It has the U.S. and several other governments, including the French, have provided training to Malian security forces. Clearly, it has not been that effective. Did not keep parts of northern Mali from falling into the hands of Islamists. But I think it's also worth pointing out that the bulk of Islamist operatives on the ground are coming from other theaters where they were involved in operations. We see Nigerians, elements of Boko Haram, obviously not trained by any Western government. Algeria, elements of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, Libya. But there are a range of militants from the region that have migrated towards Mali that have not been trained by any Western government, but that have performed jihad either there or elsewhere, including Afghanistan.
What about those who came back from Libya, Malians who came back from Libya who had supported Gaddafi there? How important an element has that been?
Well, where it's been most helpful, frankly, is their ability to bring in weapons. We heard from a New York Times correspondent at the beginning of the program. They have brought in weapons, including rocket-propelled grenades that have come from Libyan weapons caches,
you know,
stockpiles that were raided after the government collapsed.
Here's a comment online. Michael Asuman says, "The reason why France gets so wound up is easy. France is making almost all of its energy with nuclear power plants, and the uranium for those plants comes almost exclusively from mines in Mali." Is that true, Asuman?
Oh, no, Mali doesn't prove. We do not have uranium. We have gold. Mali is the third largest gold producer. So speaking of about uranium is Niger. Just the bordering country to Mali.
Next door, but not right there. I suppose it could still get your attention. Asuman, it's your country. How do you think this is likely to unfold? How do you see the path ahead?
I think this is going to be very complicated because, as Nozeter mentioned at the very beginning, now we are having the ground fight. Like today, we have the armored car who traveled to Jabali and Segu. And it's going to be a long, long war, because I have seen these people. I know that they have weapons and they are a very large group, and they control the area, they know the area, and they had time to settle and to do what they want. So I think it's going to take time. And they are also taking the local people in hostage. For example, yesterday in Kona, in Jabali, what they were doing was parking the cars in local houses. So I think there are going to be many casualties, and the humanitarian situation is going to be very tough, because people are isolated, towns are isolated, and foodstuff. I think it's necessary to do something.
A storm still gathering. French now in combat on the ground, we're told, today in Mali. Assouman Mega at Oklahoma State University, Malian, a graduate research associate there. Assouman, good luck to your family in Timbuktu and Bamako, and thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Seth Jones at the RAND Corporation in Washington, D.C. Seth, thank you very much for your insights today.
Thanks, Tom.
Tomorrow in this hour, we'll talk about Robert Greene Ingersoll, the great American agnostic. Join us. Thanks for being here today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.